Thursday, December 3rd. So this is going to be our last class. And so next week, homework number three. But it also will be posted on the internet, so you know you can get. And my intention is to fit it in to actually solve any culture cyber problems.
What we started discussing last time, we started talking about supersymmetric gauge series. And so what we did, we recalled that once we talk about arbitrary superheels, there are various ways how we can impose constraints in order to ensure that our field superfield has only irreducible components. And so one of these restrictions is a reality condition. And so if we use a reality condition, we can parametrize the most general superfield. I'm just going to write it down, and we will keep it for some time. So I'm not going to write down x dependent plus I theta chi minus I theta bar chi bar plus I over 2 theta squared. So here I have m plus I n, and then I have minus I over 2 theta bar squared m minus I n. And then we have a vector as part of the multiplet. We use a mu, and then there is plus I theta squared theta bar lambda bar plus I over 2 sigma bar mu del mu chi. Right, so there is a term like this, and then there is a complex conjugate theta, and then I have lambda plus I over 2 sigma mu del mu of chi, except that there is a bar here. Right? And so notice that this term up here actually has a correct transformation property. So it transforms as an undotted index down. We need to contract it with undotted index up here, right? So in notation, this is alpha alpha dot down mu alpha dot. So we contract dotted index, and one undotted index alpha is left, which is going to be contracted with that fellow. So this must be bar for the same reason. It must be bar here, but there is no bar there. And there is a final term here, plus 1/2 theta squared theta bar squared d plus 1/2 box c. Okay, so this is a conventional parametrization of a vector superfield. It's by definition a vector superfield because I define my superfield to satisfy this hermeticity condition. And this is the most general parametrization. So the fields that you see, scalars, are real scalars. And then you have two wild fermions. Okay, so so we still have too many components. And I promised you I will explain how those components get reduced further to a correct spin 1 supermultiplet. So so let's see how it's happening. Right. So what we're going to show now is that, in fact, remember, so there is a one component of a vector multiplet is a spin 1 field, right? So a mu is a spin 1 field. So, if you wish, you can think of this as being a photon. And there is a, in electrodynamics, there is a gauge symmetry under which the vector potential changes by del mu of alpha, where alpha is an arbitrary scalar function. And so this is gauge transformation. What I want to show you is that actually our vector superfield as defined we define a supersymmetric generalization of gauge transformation. So I'm going to call this SUSY gauge transformations. Okay. So the way how we're going to do supersymmetric gauge transformations, we're going to introduce a chiral superfield, right? It depends on y and theta. Right, so and it has in a component, it has phi plus root 2 theta psi, and then I have plus theta squared f. So all those guys depend on y, where y is x plus theta sigma theta bar. That's correct. This nine. So of course, if we have a chiral superfield, I can introduce an anti-chiral superfield, which is simply a bar of the guy above. And this guy will depend on y bar and theta bar. Now, clearly, a combination of a chiral superfield and its complex conjugate is real. And so what I can do, I can consider a transformation where my vector superfield is shifted by this combination of chiral superfields, and I declare this to be a SUSY gauge transformation. So by definition, a SUSY gauge transformation is a transformation under which my vector superfield goes into phi plus phi bar, where phi bar is a where phi is a chiral superfield. So this is a chiral superfield, and this guy is anti-chiral superfield. I'm gonna put a bar here on chiral. All right, so so it's a simple exercise, and since I wanna actually speed up a little bit so that we definitely will solve Cyber-Whitten model, so you can believe me that what we can do, we can expand this in components, right? So that depending only a function of x, and then substitute f. How does components of my superfield transform under this supersymmetric gauge transformation, right? Would that be a clear thing? I don't have to do it and just write down the result. Is that okay? Might be part of your homework assignment, but actually it will not be because it's very simple. So if we look in components, it is actually clear why did I parameterize my fields in this way, because what happens is that C will go to C plus phi of x plus phi bar of x. So those are the scalar part of the chiral superfield. Now, there is one of the wild fermions in the vector superfield chi will get transformed by a fermion in a chiral superfield. So it goes to root 2 of psi. And similarly, this guy obviously will go into this. Also what happens is that this combination M plus IM, so this also transforms under what we defined as a supersymmetric gauge transformations. So again, this is just a definition, so we'll discuss why this is a reasonable definition to call this a gauge transformation. So for now, For now, I'm just asking, how does my vector superfield transform under this chiral anti-chiral shift? So this M plus IN is a nice combination. It transforms into minus 2IF, right? So those are the three components of my chiral superfield. And so that's the way how components of the vector superfield transform appropriately. Now, so those are what I would call not interesting components. And then there are interesting ones. So the interesting ones are the following. So A mu will transform into A mu minus I. And then here I have del mu, so phi minus phi bar. Okay. So clearly this is a real function, right? And so what we have here we just have our standard gauge transformation. Right, so this is just our standard gauge transformation. Now, more interesting even, in the parameterization that I choose, the only two other fields that I did not mention is a wild fermion lambda, and it does not transform under this, what I call Susi gauge transformation. And there is also a scalar D, which also does not transform. So those two guys are gauge invariant, are Susi gauge invariant. Okay. Now, so what we're gonna do, when we're gonna construct our supersymmetric field series, we will require that the Susi gauge transformation is a symmetry of our Susi Lagrangians, a symmetry of Susi actions. We will talk today exactly how we ensure this to be the case. But once we do that, then much like when we discuss normal gauge theory, sometimes when we do computations, it's useful to do a gauge fix. So what I want to discuss now, before we actually learn that how to construct this invariant actions, I want to discuss a particular gauge fixing of the supersymmetric transformations. So this will be Susi gauge fixing. Okay, and so this Susi gauge fixing is known, the one that I'm going to talk about is known as the Vezzumino gauge. So what is a Vezzumino gauge? So what I am gonna do, you can see that I have a lot of freedom in my vector superfield if I insist that my model is invariant under the shift of an arbitrary chiral superfield, right? So in particular, what I can do, I can require that by choosing appropriately my chiral superfield, I can require that C equals to zero, right? So if C equals to zero, so this requires that we fixed the real part of phi, right? So phi is a complex scalar, right, in the chiral superfield, and so I can always choose the real part of that scalar in such a way that I ensure that in the gauge, which is called this Vezzumino gauge, this C equals to zero. Moreover, it's clear that by choosing appropriately the fermion in the chiral superfield psi, we can ensure that chi equal to zero. So this is fixed by the choice of psi. And finally, the complex M plus IN combination, M plus IN combination, I can set it equal to zero by choosing appropriately the F term of the chiral superfield. F is a complex scale here as well. And so it has enough degrees of freedom in order to give me the opportunity to impose this condition. So this is fixed. By choosing F. Maybe I have to be more explicit, by choosing real part of F and imaginary part of F in the chiral superfield. So you can see that the only thing that hasn't been fixed yet, is that I have not fixed the imaginary part of phi. Okay, so this is not fixed. And so what is happening is that in this interesting, I left the interesting field, right? So there, the fields that are left in the Vesdomino gate, right? So go here. So in this Vesdomino gauge, so in Vesdomino gauge, what is left is a vector field A mu. I have lambda. I have a scalar D, right? And these are arbitrary, right? But also notice, because I haven't fixed this Soucy gauge transformation imaginary part of phi. Imaginary part of phi is not fixed. So that tells me that I still have a normal gauge transformation, right? Because the normal gauge transformations on the vector superfield, right? So remember that A mu under the Soucy gauge transformation was transforming as A mu, and then I guess, is there a minus sign there? Yeah, minus 1/2, minus 2 imaginary part of phi. Plus. Okay. So we still have with del mu here.
We need more degrees of freedom to be left for gauge fixing, right?
Right. So notice that what's happening. Okay. So once we start talking, we'll talk about gauge, non-abelian gauge series hopefully next time, because I want to finish supersymmetric GCD today. But to answer your question, what is happening is that so this V, it contains a vector potential. So in this case, it's vector potential, gauge potential. It's in the U model. But because all components of the superfield must have the same transformation properties under gauge of local symmetry, all components of E must be in Z, must be charged under that gauge. Right? So in particular, what happens is that after this gauge fixing, this lambda and E will carry gauge charges. So once we go non-abelian, the vector potential will be the adjoint representation of the gauge group. And so those scalars, lambda and V, will also end up being in the adjoint representation of the gauge group. Now, when I do the supersymmetric gauge transformation, this only makes sense when phi is in the same representation under the gauge symmetry as the V field. So V will also be in the adjoint representation. It will have more components, and it will have precisely the right number of components to allow me to do this Vesdomino gauge, even in a non-abelian case as well. So, but since we started talking about this, can somebody tell me why? So now, once you know that all the components, so in some sense, the physical components
in the Vesdomino gauge is a vector potential, a lambda, and a d. So why those guys are gauging there? why under the Susie Gage transformation they were not changed.
Right. So very good. So why not say trust?
Because you can't have torsion. You can't have this in an abelian case.
Right. So adjoint representation for U1 is not trust. Absolutely correct. That is the reason why this is happening. Okay. Very good. So, so now you can see that we are actually exactly right as far as concerning number of bosonic and fermionic degrees of freedom. Because this is going to be ultimately a Gauge symmetry. So our vector
boson must be massless. And because it is massless, it will have only two propagating degrees of freedom, okay? Degrees of freedom, bosonic, right? Now, we have a single Weyl fermion, so this Weyl fermion, in a current context, it is called Fortino because it is a superpartner of the Gauge boson. So we have this lambda, right? So in this case, we'll call it Fortino. In general, in a non-abelian case, it is called a Gaugino. So that's a supersymmetric partner of a Gauge boson. Again, it must be charged under the appropriate representation of the Gauge group. And as we just figure out, it must be a joint. So this will be Gaugino in general. And notice that this guy has two fermionic degrees of freedom, also two degrees of freedom, and they are fermionic. And so what we appear to have an excess, we have an excess of one real degree of freedom, right? So remember that D is a part of the vector multiplet, and D is a real field. So what appears to be the case is that we have an additional single bosonic degree of freedom. But what we will discover today is that actually D is a non-propagating degree of freedom. So it's much like F component in a context of chiral superfields. So D will be non-propagating. And so you can see that by choosing in a smart way the supersymmetric gauge, we actually constructed an irreducible representation corresponding to a massless vector multiple. All right, guys. So something that I want to discuss right now. So that's a technical part, but for one reason it will be useful for you when you do your homework. So so what I want to do is, so once we have this. Once I go into Vezzumino gauge, and in fact, lots of discussions I'm going to do in the Vezzumino gauge, just for its simplicity. Of course, once I choose this Vezzumino gauge, my theory is invariant only under ordinary gauge transformation. It's no longer invariant under supersymmetric gauge transformations. I did the gauge fixing. But it's a useful gauge to do the computation. So in this gauge, my vector superfield takes a very simple form. So I have sigma mu theta bar, and then I have a mu, and then I have plus I theta squared theta bar lambda bar, and then I have minus I theta bar squared theta lambda, and then I have plus 1/2 theta squared theta bar squared times D, okay? So those are the only components of the vector superfield that will survive in the Vezzumino gauge. Now, notice an interesting fact. So this vector superfield does not have a component that does not contain any theta. What this means, that when I start computing the powers of this vector superfield, it will end up. And in fact, it will end up right here. I cannot cube. If I cube it, right, so every term has at least one theta parameter. So if I take a cube of it, then I will have three thetas, which must vanish because I have only two independent theta components, and those are Grassmann variables. So it will vanish. So the only non-trivial power of E that we have actually will come from a square of this guy. So let's evaluate it. We will need it later today. So it will be this, right? So this is theta sigma nu theta bar a nu. Okay, and now I can use the result from your homework assignment number one, right? So this was homework one. Which allowed us to actually simplify this combination. So if we do that, we will get the answer. It's minus 1/2 theta squared theta bar squared, and then I just have a contraction a mu. Okay, so this Wessel-Minow gauge is very useful because the powers of the vector superfield take a particularly simple form there. Right, so we constructed V, and V, as you can see, is an analog of the gauge potential. And so now, once we want to construct a supersymmetric gauge series, we want to construct an analog of the field strength, an analog of something that's invariant under the gauge transformations. And so that's going to be our next step. So we're going to construct a supersymmetric field strength corresponding to this U1 field. Okay, so we are constructing SUSY field strengths. Okay, now the important thing is that even though we will do the computations in this Wessel-Minow gauge, but I insisted that all my theories invariant under this larger gauge transformation, under the full SUSY gauge transformation. So in ordinary QFT, right, so what we had that our field strength was invariant under, so if I act with it with gauge transformation, it was invariant. But so now what we want in SUSY quantum field series, right, what we want something here that will be invariant under SUSY gauge transformations, right? Not only, again, just because I choose to fix a gauge to be Wessel-Minow gauge, the only reason I should be allowed to do that if everything that I construct is invariant before the gauge fixing. That's why it's crucial to insist on this. So I'm just going to give you the answer, and then we will prove that actually makes sense. So the definition of a supersymmetric field strength is given by this. So the supersymmetric field strength is W alpha. So alpha is a spinner index, right? So it's a left-handed spinner index. Right, so notice that this is a new object. When we talk about a chiral superfield, it didn't carry neither chiral nor vector superfield. It didn't carry any index. It was a Lorentz invariant. But this guy actually carries a Lorentz index. So it carries a spinner index. And I'm going to define it. I'm going to define it in this way. So it's d bar squared d alpha v. So again, this is just a definition. I just declare this to be my field strength, okay? And also, I can construct a complex conjugate to this field strength. So the complex conjugate I will denote as bar, and it must carry the right-handed spinner index. So it's going to be minus 1/2 d squared d bar alpha dot acted on V. And so you can see where the spinner index arises, because this is an uncontracted index in the covariant superderivative. Okay, so now the first thing I want to
Factors of 2 and 4, right?
Oh, sorry. 1, 2, 4.
So,
we're going to make a powerful statement. So, well, we're going to make two powerful statements. So the statement number A, W alpha and W alpha log bar, so they are invariant under Susi gauge transformations. Okay, so that's statement number one. Now the second statement is that W alpha is actually a chiral superfield. So we're going to show that W alpha is a chiral superfield. And that immediately would make W bar alpha dot an anti-chiral superfield, is an anti-chiral superfield. So we're going to prove these statements now. Okay, so I'm going to start with B. And so I'm going to use the exercise that I asked you to do in homework number 2. So the last problem in homework number 2, I'm not going to do that because you already did this. So from homework 2, what we'll learn that for any, so if I take an arbitrary superfield U, okay, then this combination d bar squared U is a chiral superfield. Okay, so what this means that if I act with d on it, with an arbitrary index alpha dot, it will vanish, right? So then d bar squared U is chiral superfield, right? And alternatively, d squared V is anti-chiral superfield. And that simply means that this combination vanishes. D squared U equals to 0. This is actually an almost obvious statement, right? Because D is D contains is a powers of theta or powers of theta bar, and so it's not very dissimilar as trying to take a cube of theta parameters. So it's not a surprise that that's indeed happening. But this is an exercise that that was in homework number 2. So what we're going to do now, we're actually going to prove the first statement. That is that our field strength, as defined, is invariant under supersymmetric gauge transformation. And once we say these words, then it's obviously invariant under normal gauge transformation, right? So I guess I want to add this as a word. And thus, invariant under ordinary gauge transformations, because ordinary gauge transformations are just part of the more general supersymmetric gauge transformation. So the proof goes as follows. So let's just see how W alpha gets transformed. So W alpha get transformed into W alpha minus a quarter d bar squared d alpha. And here, let's see, 5 plus 5 bar. Okay, so that's going to be a transformation, the transformation of my W. And so what we're going to show that this guy actually equals to 0 for any chiral superfield. Well, first of all, notice that, so it's a combination of chiral superfield plus anti-chiral. But when, because this guy is an anti-chiral superfield, then it will be annihilated by d alpha. right, B alpha acted on phi bar will be zero because this guy is anti-chiral superfield. So in fact, the only piece that we need to look at is this combination, D alpha acted on a chiral superfield. Okay, so equals. Well, what we need to do, okay, so in principle, we can just expand it, and I can say, oh, you guys can do it. But there is a smarter way to do it rather than expansion, and that's using supersymmetry algebra. So we know that d alpha and d bar alpha dot, so the commutator of two covariant derivatives is 2p alpha alpha dot, right? So we can use that to actually prove the statement in a very simple manner. So let's do that. So I can continue this equality sign. So I'm going to write it down as d bar alpha dot here, and then here I have d alpha acted on phi. Right. So I expressed explicitly what d squared is. So this guy is minus d bar alpha dot d alpha. Phi. Right, I have a minus sign. I'm just trying to be careful. I changed the summation convention, so there is a flipping sign. Then this is minus d bar alpha dot. And now I can use the Susi algebra to actually anti-commute d by d. And so that gives me 2p alpha alpha dot minus d alpha d bar alpha dot acted on phi. But now this guy will kill phi, right? Because it's a chiral superfield, and we are acting on it with d bar. But then those two operators actually commute with themselves. Right, so we have d bar and p alpha. This is just a bosonic field, and as a part of a superformed Fourier algebra, those two things compute. And so we can think that we act with that guy on the field phi as well. But it is a d bar acting on a chiral superfield, so it will vanish. So the answer is zero. So what we did show, we showed that our superfield is invariant under supersymmetric gauge transformation. And that's why actually it warrants to call it a field set, because part of those transformations are ordinary gauge transformations. And so the combination that we constructed is actually invariant under gauge transformation. And so what this means is that if we evaluate it, this is what we're going to do. We're going to take a look exactly in some more details what this superfield W is. It must contain a field strength, okay? It must contain only quantities which are invariant under Susi transformations. All right, guys, so this is our next task. So we're gonna evaluate W. So there are various ways how you do it. Okay, so I gave you the definition. What is the definition? Yeah, so the definition, okay, there is a definition somewhere. So one way is just substitute everything and do the algebra, but then it's actually complicated. It's very long, and so there are some shortcuts. And so what I want to do, I want to show you some of those shortcuts, how to do it faster, which is useful if you face more complicated models. Okay, so first of all, we showed that it's gauge invariant, so it doesn't really matter. So now we can really say that there is no problem of fixing a gauge, at least part of the gauge, supersymmetric gauge. And so what we will do, we will use a Vesuvino gauge, right? I will use that gauge. So what I want to do now, since we showed that W alpha, so the way how we naively we would have written W alpha, we would have written it, it's a superfield, so it depends on x, theta, and theta bar. But we know that it is a chiral superfield, right? So we know that this is a chiral superfield. And so there must be a way of writing this combination involving y and theta. Okay, so what this tells us that rather than doing the computation, to remember that W alpha was equal to minus a quarter d bar squared d alpha acted on a vector superfield. And so our vector superfield, again, we discussed it today, depended on x, theta, and theta bar. But the answer, at the end of the day, when we apply all this, should depend only on y and y bar. And so this is a strong hint, that we might get a simplification if we rewrite all the computations, try to use the computation in terms of y coordinate. Instead, x coordinate. So I'm just gonna. Because I will try to keep track of that, but I am not guaranteeing you that it will not be confusing, because sometimes I will lose this half. So what this means? This means that by definition, this is del over del y mu. Okay, without a half. Del mu was del over del x mu. And so now I'm going to denote y hat as del over del y mu. Okay, so the first step, so the problem that we need to do, we just need to do this explicit computation. So the first step we need to do is to express the gauge potential v in this chiral coordinate. Okay? At least express it in terms of y. We cannot express it entirely in terms of y and theta. It will necessarily contain theta bar because v is not a chiral superfield. It's a sum. For one reason, it transforms as a sum plus chiral, a chiral plus anti-chiral. So it cannot be a chiral superfield itself. So. But what we can do, we can rewrite it in terms of y and theta, theta bar. So we can always do that. So in this Vesuvino gauge, let me write it down one more time here. So I have a mu, and then I have plus I theta squared theta bar lambda bar. So all of these guys depend on x, right? So in this parameterization, it depended on x minus I theta bar squared theta lambda, and then I have plus 1/2 theta squared theta bar squared d. So all the fields, all the components here depend only on x, right? So those guys depend on x. But what I notice is that if I look a mu as a function of y, right? So this is the same as a mu of x plus I theta sigma theta bar. And so I can write this down. I can write this down as a mu, right, plus del mu of a mu, right? And then I have I theta sigma nu theta bar. So so the way how I can rewrite my vector superfield now, I can rewrite it as a function of y theta and theta bar by simply inverting this relation. So I have minus theta sigma mu, and then I have theta bar. So here, what I can write down, a mu as a function of y, right? And then I, strictly speaking, this guy depends on x, but what I'm going to do, I'm just going to do something bad. I'm just going to write it down in this way, and then we will think for a second and understand that that's okay. Okay? So I just looked at the first term in the vector superfield, and so what I did, well, I said that this guy is a function of x, is what I have here minus this term, right? So this is a mu of y, and then what I did, I replaced x with y. Okay? So the reason, why am I allowed to do that is because if you expand this in terms of x, you will get theta and theta bar, right? You will have one theta and one theta bar, but you already have theta and theta bar. So you have two thetas, but then there is a theta in front, so you will have three thetas altogether. So I can do this trick, and it will work precisely because if I were to expand it back in terms of thetas, there would have been three thetas every time. Now, all the remaining terms, for the same reason, I can think that everything depends on y coordinate now, right? So again, as I expand, there will be more powers. There will be more powers of theta, just to ensure that it will vanish. Plus 1/2 theta squared, theta bar squared, d of 1. Okay, so we achieved the first step. So we wrote all the, we expressed the vector potential in terms of a chiral coordinate y. Okay, so very good. Let's see. So the next step, which I'm not sure, but it could also be a part of your, I don't remember now, part of your homework assignment number two, is we can express covariant derivatives in terms of y, theta, and theta bar, rather than in terms of x, theta, and theta bar. Again, this is just change of variables. So if you think what I'm doing, I'm just going in a superspace from x, theta, and theta bar, to y, theta, and theta bar. So that's a non-singular change of variables. And so what I have the d alpha equals del over del theta alpha plus 2i sigma mu alpha alpha dot. I have theta alpha dot, and then I have hat. Is called hat. So this means that I differentiate with respect to y. And this guy, alpha dot, is minus del over del theta bar alpha dot. So now it immediately becomes clear why the chiral superfield, is a function of y and theta, or in other words, a very quick check, this guy on a chiral superfield must vanish, and it's not as surprising, because a chiral superfield is a function of y and theta. It doesn't depend on theta bar, and d bar in this chiral coordinates does not contain y, and it doesn't contain theta. That's why this identity is trivial for the chiral superfield. Okay. So I'm not, again, this is a computation which I don't want to do, because first of all, it's very straightforward now. I saved you a lot of time by going into y coordinate. I'm just going to mention some of the facts that will simplify the computation. So this combination del alpha dot over del over theta beta dot, right? So this combination is precisely the d bar alpha dot d bar alpha dot. Okay, and a useful thing, something again, this was part of your first homework, was to show, actually it wasn't your homework, this is something we did in class, we showed that this guy equals to minus 4. And so what this tells you that that if I act with d squared, right, written in terms of y, I'm not gonna write down in terms of what. So for now we changed our coordinates on the superspace. So it's always y theta and theta bar. So if I act with this on a field that depends on y theta and theta bar, right? So I cannot have in this superfield, I can have either theta to the zero, theta bar to the zeroth power. I can have theta bar to the first power, or theta bar squared. Right. So there are those three possibilities. But then d squared will annihilate this guy, right? Because I differentiate with respect. I always differentiate with respect to theta bar. So this component will vanish. This component will vanish as well. And so the only component that will survive is the component that's proportional to theta bar squared. But when d squared acts on theta bar squared, it gives me minus 4. So the answer of this operation is simply minus 4x. And I need to extract the theta bar squared component. So, all right, guys. So, do you want me to do right now on the blackboard the computations of d squared d bar, or in principle, it's clear how to be done, and we can save some time by letting me just write down the ends. Do on the blackboard or not? No. All right. That's great. So we can talk slightly more physics then. So if we do that, okay. This is what we're gonna find. We're going to find that W alpha equals right. So I skipped some steps, but there is one slight subtlety, and so I want to point out this subtlety in the computation. So once we do this computation, this is what we will get. And then there is plus delta alpha beta d, okay? So now, so now all the field that you have here depends on y, right? So this depends on y and theta. It must depend only on y and theta because, for one reason, as you can see that d bar squared will extract the theta bar squared component and fill all the rest. That's why it will end up being chiral. And so then I have minus I sigma mu bar. And so here I have alpha beta index. And then I have del nu of a mu. And then I have minus I del mu a mu delta alpha beta. Okay. And this guy, I'm just going to multiply it by theta beta. And then there is one more term plus theta squared, sigma mu alpha dot del mu lambda bar alpha dot. So you can see that the only non-contracting index is index alpha. All the other indices are contracting, and it's a spinner index. And it doesn't look like exactly that this is what we've seen, but this is what you will get if you just do the algebra. So what is the very last step that will make it obvious that everything is gauge invariant, right? So in this term, in this formula, things are not gauge invariant, right? So they at least naively, are not, well, let me put it this way, are not obviously gauge invariant because they still have this del mu of A mu, right? And in fact, what is happening here is the following, that this combination, right, I have matrix multiplication of sigma nu, sigma bar mu, right? And so here's what I need alpha beta index of this matrix multiplication. What I can do, I can write this down, so this is the only tricky part in the computation. So I'm just gonna explain this. Nu bar. So I'm just gonna separate it into a symmetric combination. I decompose it into a reducible representation under the Lorentz group. So there will be a symmetric tensor, and then there will be an anti-symmetric tensor, sigma bar mu minus sigma nu, sigma bar nu. Okay, so clearly I haven't done anything, right? So it's an identity. But then what happens is that this combination up here is one of the identities involving polymatrices, okay? So it turns out that the combination here is 1/2, and the combination here is minus 2, and then I have eta mu nu, and then I have delta, okay? So I guess here I want to keep alpha beta, right? So what I will have in the symmetric combination, I will have minus 2 eta mu nu, and then I have delta chronicle alpha beta, and then I can do nothing with the anti-symmetric combination. Sigma nu, sigma bar mu, minus sigma nu, sigma bar nu, and then alpha beta. So now, once we have this, so what I want to do, I want to rewrite this combination here using the identity that we just found. And so let's just concentrate on those two terms, right? There is nothing funny going on with the other terms. So so what I will have minus I, right? So so this term here is minus eta mu nu delta alpha beta, right? So the first term will give me plus I, and so it instructs me to contract mu and nu indices. So I will get del mu of A mu delta alpha beta, right, with a plus sign. And then the other term, I have minus I over 2, minus I over 2, and then I have sigma nu, sigma bar nu, minus sigma nu, sigma bar nu, and then I have del nu A nu, right? So here I have to keep track of a spinner indices alpha and beta. And then the last term, again, I can do nothing with it. But notice that what happens, that once we use this identity, the first term and the last term will cancel. So those two guys will cancel. But now, notice even more. So this term is anti-symmetric under the exchange of new and new indices. And so what I can write it down, I can write it down that this is minus I over 2 sigma nu sigma bar mu. Keep only one term and write down, rewrite this anti-symmetric combination. So this will be equivalent to this. Okay. So, and the remaining guys will cancel. And so notice that what we have. So we have that the answer is minus I over 2. Then I have sigma nu, sigma bar mu. And then here I have alpha beta. And then here I have f nu nu. Okay? So, right. I want to write down one more line, but now you can see that very nicely, those two terms here, after we use the identity, combine into a term that contains a field strength. So what we showed is indeed, as we expected, that the supersymmetric field strengths must be invariant automatically under ordinary gauge transformations, which was an unfixed part of the supersymmetric gauge transformations in our Vesinino gauge. All right, so any questions? No? Good. So, what I can do, I can now do the same thing with W bar alpha dot, and that's just taking complex conjugate of I had before, and I'm not gonna write it down. Okay, so one of the things that most likely will be part of your next homework assignment is that there are Bianchi identities, right, in electromagnetism. And so you might have expected that there are a supersymmetric generalization of these Bianchi identities, and you are correct. So again, I'm not gonna discuss this anymore, but just mention that there is this super Bianchi identity. And so the super Bianchi identity tells that if I act with d alpha on w alpha, then this is the same as d bar alpha dot acted on w bar alpha dot. Okay, so this is analog of Bianchi identity, which tells that if I take a d of a 2 form, then I will get a 0. Okay, so this was an ordinary Bianchi identity. Okay, and I'm not going to discuss why this is a generalization, but believe me, it's. All right, so, and it's a good exercise to prove it, but the proof is actually trivial also, so maybe it will end up being your homework. Good. All right, guys, so we are done. We understood what it is, a field strength, and we also saw why it makes sense to call it a supersymmetric generalization of the field strength. A field strength we put inside a chiral superfield. Notice that this chiral superfield is a little bit funny. We used to think that the first component of our chiral superfield was a boson, right? And then the fermions enter as higher components in the chiral superfield, but that was not necessary, right? So a chiral superfield, in principle, can carry arbitrary spin. So in this case, our chiral superfield carry a left-handed spin, right? And so the first component of this chiral superfield is actually a left-handed fermion. So now we want to construct some invariant. Now we want to construct a supersymmetric supersymmetric Lagrangians, right? Let's see. Okay. And that's an easy thing to do, right? So what we know with you from general theory of chiral superfields is that if we have an arbitrary chiral superfield, so if U is chiral superfield, so then we can construct a Susi invariant Lagrangian just by evaluating an integral of this chiral superfield over half of the superspace. So this leads to Susi Lagrangian. So at our disposal, what we have a chiral superfield Q alpha, W alpha. And so what we could have done and what we will eventually do, we will take this chiral superfield and integrate with respect to half of the superspace. So the slight problem here is that our chiral superfield carries spin under a Lorentz group, and so so this Lagrangian indeed will be invariant under supersymmetry transformations, but it will not be invariant under Lorentz transformation, right? So it will transform under Lorentz transformation as a spin 1/2 object. And so what we need to do, we need to contract this index somehow. And the obvious thing to do it would be to contract it again with a chiral superfield, except that the one where we raise the index. But now if I want to now have my convention, my standard convention, so it will be something like this. So the object, so this object is a Lorentz scalar, and it's a product, it's a bilinear in chiral superfield, so it will lead to Susi Lagrangian. So what I can do, I can introduce a quantity, so I can introduce a coupling, right?
So
because the product of two chiral superfields is a chiral superfield, right? So the reason why it's a product of two chiral superfields, if you have du equals zero, d bar of u1 and u2 equals to zero, but those act like normal derivatives. So a normal normal rules apply. So when I have d acted on u1, u2, right? So this is d acted on u1 times u2, right, plus u1, plus or minus sign, depending whether it's bosonic field, bosonic under Lorentz group or fermionic, d bar of u2, right? So those guys will vanish, and so they're telling me that this guy must vanish. So this is what we say that chiral superfield form an algebra. It forms a ring, right? Called a chiral ring, meaning that if I take two objects in the algebra, multiply them, I'll get the same object. So what I want to do, I want to introduce a coupling, and I'm going to introduce it in a funny way. The reason why I'm going to introduce it in this funny way will be clear once we evaluate this. So 16 pi, okay? So tau is a coupling constant, and I'm just going to say what tau is. So by definition, so this is a definition of tau. So tau is complex, right? So it takes the following form. It's theta over 2 pi plus I over 4 pi over g squared. Now, what do I mean by theta? It's not the Grassmann variable. I'm sorry. I'm going to use theta. This is a theta angle, right? So if you haven't heard about what is a theta angle in gauge series, you will learn about it, okay? Actually, you will learn about it in about 5 minutes, but not into much detail. We will talk more about that when we talk about non-abelian gauge series. So this is just another coupling. So this is a theta angle. So it's a real You can think of this as a real number. Okay, it's a number, it's not a field. And this guy, G, is a gauge coupling. Gauge coupling. Again, it's just a real number. But so what I did, and you will see once we evaluate what actually the supersymmetric action looked like, you will see that, you will see what this theta angle corresponds to. And I will mention to you why you never heard about it before, if you haven't heard about it before. How many of you haven't heard about theta angle? Maybe. Okay, good. So you will see where it enters, and then I will mention, just say in one word why you didn't, why it's not so much publicized in normal courses. But it is important for us, very, very important. For one thing is that this is a complex coupling. So what we did, we introduced this tau, and tau is what's called a complexified gauge coupling. So this combination is the one that naturally happens to enter in supersymmetric gauge series. So now, as usual, what we do, we add plus Hermitian conjugate. Okay, so this is a some Lagrangian, right? So this Lagrangian is obviously invariant under supersymmetry. So this Lagrangian is first Susi invariant. But second, what we discussed with you is that our Lagrangians contain a Kala potential and contain a superpotential. So in this general classification, the Lagrangian that we constructed so far comes from a superpotential. And so, but we already showed with you that superpotential does not receive quantum correction. And so what, notice what we're able to do here. We constructed, and we will see that the kinetic term for gauge fields. So this will contain your standard F mu nu term. I will write down in a second if we evaluate this integral what we will get. But notice what I want to emphasize here is that it enters in the superpotential, right? This is a superpotential. And so, unlike the kinetic terms for chiral superfields, which enter into a Kala term, and they can be renormalized by loop corrections, in this particular case, what we are discovering is that this classical answer is exact, including any quantum correction. So is non-renormalizable. Non-renormalizable is a bad doesn't receive, does not receive quantum corrections. Because of this non-renormalization theorem for superpotential. So, what I'm gonna do right now, I'm just gonna write it down for you. Again, this, I will not even ask you whether you want me to evaluate this thing or not. I'm just gonna write you the answer. Again, it's a straightforward exercise. We have an explicit expression for the chiral superfield. We have an explicit definition for tau. So all you have to do is expand and carefully evaluate this Grassmann integral, which simply means that you have to pick up the theta squared term. So everything is very straightforward and simple, though you have to be careful, okay? So if you do the algebra, this is what you will find out. So this Lagrangian that we talked about takes the following form. And so you will understand some of the pieces. You will recognize some of the pieces. I mean, you will understand everything to be trivial. Okay. So I have F mu nu term. Okay. So this is your standard kinetic, standard abelian U1 gauge theory. Then I told you that a D term, but I didn't talk much about it yet. So the D component was non-dynamical. I was promising you that that's the case. Now, you shouldn't be surprised, because this D enters into the vector superfield, but it enters in the superpotential. And superpotential cannot produce kinetic terms for scalar fields. That's why it's not a surprise that D ended up not having any kinetic term. So that's the way how D will enter. Then there is a minus lambda. Okay, I think I made a mistake in the sign, and that's the right, must be this is the right sign, I believe. Is it correct? Okay, let me go on send some server. I have plus, I might be off by a sign, so. Then there is this term here, del mu lambda bar over g squared, okay? And then there is this term. So those are terms that depends on G, your standard gauge coupling. But then there is a term where this theta term enters. So it turns out that it enters in this particular form. Okay. Okay, so I don't have any integrals yet. So it's F mu nu. F tilde mu nu, okay? And so this F tilde mu nu, is a Hodge dual. Is a Hodge dual of normal F mu nu, okay? So in my conventions, epsilon 0, 1, 2, 3, I believe is equal to minus 1 when I was deriving this expression. So you can see that, let's discuss, and we will end the discussion here. And next time we will talk about supersymmetric QED. So at this stage, what we have our gauge field. We have a scalar, right? The scalar D doesn't have any kinetic term. It's a non-dynamical field. And its equation of motion will set it, I can integrate it out. And the integrating it out means setting D equal to zero. Okay, so it's non-dynamical, much like F terms in non-linear sigma model. Now, what we also have, we have a super partner of a vector boson, and that's this wild fermion lambda. So the two things that we notice about this lambda is that there is no mass term. Well, you cannot write down, if you have a single wild fermion, you cannot write down a mass term for it, that's to begin with. But second, notice that it doesn't contain a covariant derivative, it contains a normal derivative, which is a statement that this lambda doesn't carry any charge under the U1 gauge group, which is again related to our previous discussion that lambda will be in the adjoint representation of the abelian U1, and so it must not be charged. So those are the three terms that we are familiar with. Now, this last term is not maybe very familiar to you, but this is, in fact, a topological term. And that's one of the reasons why it might not be familiar. So the coefficients, theta 2 pi squared, are defined in such a way, in other words, I normalize theta appropriately in such a way that when I consider my gauge theory on a four manifold, we can prove it's a topological property. It depends only on the characteristic of my four manifold. And it turns out that we can prove that this quantity, if I have a vector field defined on a four manifold, so this vector field will have a strength f mu nu. So if I evaluate this integral, I will get an in. Okay, so this is a topological quantity. It doesn't enter into any equations of motion. Okay, that's why you never heard about it. But it will be important in our case, especially it will be important in a context of non-abelian gauge series. And in fact, this number is the instanton number. So we'll talk about that later. All right. Let's see. Now, can somebody tell me? So we have a somewhat very peculiar thing. So we have, if we think what we just did, we took a U1 gauge theory, we made it supersymmetric, and then everything we did was classical, but then we said that because the Lagrangian that we obtained comes from a superpotential, it doesn't receive quantum correction. So can somebody tell me why that thing is exact? Why that thing does not receive quantum correction? It must also be because the statement is so powerful, we should be able to prove it some other way without, you know, without resorting to a supersymmetry. Yeah. No, there are particles in the theory, right? There is a gauge boson. Right, so the right answer is that there is no interaction, okay? So the theory is free, okay? And the reason why it is free, because the only particle is, so we have a gauge boson, but as you said, the gauge boson, what you implied is that in abelian gauge series, gauge bosons are not self-interacting. There will be self-interaction in non-abelian series. But moreover, what happens is that So there is no interaction in the gauge sector, even though we have a fermion, but that fermion is uncharged, so it cannot come up into loops and renormalize the gauge coupling. That's why, even from the perspective of ordinary quantum field theory, the theory that we constructed is a trivial field theory, okay? And it's exact quantum mechanically. Now, in order to make this theory interesting, we need to introduce electrons. We need to introduce a supersymmetric generalization of electrons, and that will end up, we end up constructing a supersymmetric QED. So just to continue the discussion, what we had here, so in other words, in order, so we have an electrodynamic, SUSY electrodynamic, but okay, electrodynamic is not the right word probably for a U1. So we had SUSY U1, and then we want to go. I want to show you why, in doing this step, there will be quantum correction. I want us to understand why the quantum corrections will arise. So we go from SUSY U1 to supersymmetric QED. And so what that means that what we would need to do, we would need to take what we have here, right, and we need to add charged fields, okay? Charged fields, right? Even though there are fermions, in a vector multiply, they are useless to us in the context of abelian theory. Now, these charged fields must be a part, if we talk about supersymmetric models, so the easiest way of thinking about them as charged chiral superfields. So this we can think of as being a charged chiral superfield. But now, once we want to construct a supersymmetric action for chiral superfield, remember that we need two terms. We need a kinetic term for chiral superfield, and then we need a potential term. Now, a potential term is something that will come from a superpotential, and kinetic terms for the chiral superfield will come from a Keller potential. So the way how quantum corrections will happen in the supersymmetric QED, because the kinetic term for our charged superfield will receive a wave function renormalization. So this thing will still not be renormalized, but the Keller potential for the chiral superfield will receive quantum corrections, and this will leak through to the gauge sector, and there will be all these phenomena that we are familiar in ordinary gauge theories, like cranning of the gauge coupling and things like that. So the origin of that is the fact that the Taylor potential will be renormalized. Now, in the remaining 1 minute, I'm just going to mention one last thing, and we are done with this model. And so next time we talk about that one. So there is one other term. There is one other term that that I can construct, right? So you can ask, okay, did you construct the most general, if you have this abelian vector superfield, is what we discussed the most general, or there can be something else? And the answer to that, there can be nothing else interesting. Well, if I start taking powers of this quantity, I always have to have this quantity in order to have a Lorentz scalar, but if I have it, it will be a high derivative electrodynamics, right? So if I will be considering terms like that, so it will be a high derivative electrodynamics, and well, if we start entering gauge fields, it will not be renormalizable, okay, by power counting. So this will lead to higher derivatives or Dirac-Born-Infeld-like electrodynamics. But there is one thing that I did not tell you, which can lead to a supersymmetric piece. And that's if I look at the vector superfield V, right? And so what I can do, so we know that the field strength was a chiral superfield, but V was not a chiral superfield. It was a vector superfield. So what I can do, I can integrate over the whole superspace, okay? And I can introduce coupling 2K for the vector superfield. Now, if I do that, maybe somewhere on the blackboard there is an expansion, but you can believe me, the only thing that will survive in this integral is K times D. So this is a new piece that is a supersymmetric by construction. And this term is gauge invariant, right? Notice it's invariant under Suessy gauge transformations because V goes to V plus phi plus phi dagger, right? But D4 of this combination is always zero, right? Remember, this is a shift that we could have always done for a Keller potential. Remember that a Keller potential was invariant if I take an arbitrary function of chiral superfield and some other arbitrary function of an anti-chiral superfield. So D4 of this guy is the same as the D4 of that guy. So so this term is invariant under Suessy gauge transformations, and it is a supersymmetric term. So it will lead to a contribution K times D. And so this term is called a Fayette-Leonopoulos term, and we'll talk more about it once we start talking about Suessy QED. All right, guys, so see you next week.